From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Christianity after religion. The end of church and the birth of a new spiritual awakening. On February 14th, Harper One published a book by that title written by Diana Butler Bass, and that book continues to rank highly on religion and spirituality bestseller lists. On April 17, the Free Press released the latest book by Ross Douthat. The title is Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. And that book also continues to rank highly on religion and spirituality bestseller lists. Now, the remarkable thing is, each of these well-received books starts with a similar acknowledgement that traditional religion, specifically mainstream Christianity, is facing giant challenges in 2012 America. Both authors acknowledge the vast influence of organized religion on our culture and society. And then, at that point, these authors diverge wildly on both their analyses of how we got to where we are, as well as on what needs to happen next. But taken together, these books help us get a fascinating, if unplanned, cumulative look at two very divergent perspectives on a single issue that is vitally important to many millions of the American people. Earlier this summer, a dialogue began between the two authors involved. On July 14th, in the pages of the New York Times, where he's the youngest op-ed writer in history, Mr. Douthat stated bluntly that, quote, liberal Christianity has simply collapsed. Dr. Bass quickly responded in the Huffington Post, where she comments regularly on culture and religion. Her column was headlined, Can Christianity Be Saved? A response to Ross Douthat. Well, it wasn't long, you got it, before Mr. Douthat took to his New York Times blog to craft his response to Dr. Bass. Well, the exchange makes for fascinating reading. Here are two sharp minds with divergent viewpoints, but each author sincere and studied in the author's knowledge of the issue. That's why, in following this public correspondence, we felt it could be both interesting and important to bring these minds together for a face-to-face conversation. There's a lot to be learned, and that's precisely what we've done. So with me in the studio right now is Ross Douthat, author of Bad Religion, and joining me also is Dr. Diana Butler Bass, author of Christianity After Religion. I have locked the door. And so I welcome both of you to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being here.
It's great. I'm glad that it's not just my mind, but my body, too, that's here.
That's right.
The power of prayer can unlock any door, though. So just keep that in mind. Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, that's great. Well, look, I'm fascinated with the similarities of how each of you view organized Christianity's current state in this country, and then with such unanimity of voice, you go off in opposite directions when it comes to what you say this means for the future. So I want to start, as you would expect, with an overview of where are we headed from each of your perspectives. And I'd like for you just to describe succinctly what your perspective on this is. Doesn't matter who goes first, because I want to hear from each of you. So one of you pick that up, if you will.
Sure. I can start. I'll try and be quick, and I'll just try and cover, I think, some points that we agree on. Basically, I think the central place that both of our books start from is the fact that over the last 10 years especially, but really over the last couple of generations, there has been a what you might call a deinstitutionalization of American Christianity, in which institutional churches, both Catholic and Protestant, have gotten weaker overall. Even though if you ask Americans about, you know, questions like do you believe in God, how, you know, do you pray and so on, America looks roughly as, you know, as religious in that sense as ever. So it's – we're a less churched country but still a very religious country. And I think, you know, so there's this broader trend, and then there's, I think, an acceleration of the trend in the last decade. And I think Dr. Bass refers to a religious recession, right, to sort of describe – to link it to our current economic troubles. But I think really dating it rightly back to either the first part of the third millennium or even the 1990s. And that shows up in the rise of what – you know, a couple of sociologists have called the nuns, not N-U-N-S, but N-O-N-E-S, Americans who say they have no religious affiliation. You know, they aren't Methodists or Presbyterians or Catholics. And this is one of the new and striking religious trends in American life. And so overall, we're looking at a landscape where the traditional Christian churches are having a harder and harder time reaching people. And this phenomenon exists across the spectrum. And, you know, we can discuss sort of the liberal Christianity versus conservative Christianity divide, but I think we agree that it's a challenge facing everyone from the most conservative evangelical to the most progressive-minded Episcopalian.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and I can tell that you've spent some time reading some things I've written, and I certainly have read some things you've written. And I was really surprised when I opened up your book and found – pretty much the same diagnosis of the culture in the first several pages that, you know, that I do in my book too, because we've never met before. I had no idea you were writing the book you wrote. I don't think you had any idea I was writing.
Spies, actually. Plus, it's all around your house. Every PDF you downloaded, I downloaded as well. And I think it suggests that, at least in terms of the data, this underlying trend is hard to argue with.
Yeah, and it's been very striking that in the last 5 or 6 years, what's come out are some of the best surveys probably ever done by sociologists about American religion. And across the board, they're revealing the same thing, is that there is this slow motion collapse of institutional Christianity that's been going on since the 1970s. And then what I call the Great Religious Recession, the acceleration really since the beginning of the millennium. And that has profound consequences on American society as a whole, consequences that I'm actually quite worried about, as I know that you are too. And this is a changing moment of the way that Americans are thinking about their religious lives, are gathering in community, and will be exploring how you generate sort of communities of practice that create spiritual and social capital that are related to larger issues about poverty and how we get along as a country, politics. And so I think that this is a really important subject. And I'm really glad that you have tackled it as well.
Are we at a crisis moment or an opportunity moment?
Well, I think that the language of slow motion that you just used, I think is very useful, because it is a crisis moment, but it's a slow burning crisis. You know, we're not going to wake up tomorrow and find that, you know, the Roman Catholic Church in the United States has suddenly disappeared or anything like that. And you aren't seeing some, you know, there was a poll that just came out today showing that the number of self-professed atheists in the United States has gone way up over the last, I think, 10 years, 5 years, I'm not sure. And that's true, but it's going up from a very, very low threshold. It's something like 4 or 5% of Americans now identify as atheists, which means that we're still living in a country that has very significant institutional churches where, you know, sort of institutional religion is still very influential, notwithstanding its decline. So I think it's important to see this for what it is, not a sort of, you know, it's not that the house is, you know, on fire in every room or something. Mm-hmm. It's more that the house is slowly sinking into quicksand or something, mm-hmm. if I can mix metaphors a little.
Nice biblical analogy, yeah, though. Yeah. You know, you got to look out for that sand. I think that part of the question about is this a crisis or is it an opportunity, I always think that those two things are very closely related. Mm-hmm. But I also think that it depends on what sort of quarter of Christianity in the United States you're looking at. I think that for legacy Protestantism or ecumenical Protestantism or liberal Protestantism, whatever you want to call it, the thing that we used to call mainline churches, I think that actually is a crisis over there. And, you know, I am one. I'm an Episcopalian and known as a progressive or liberal Episcopalian. These are churches I love. I work with them all the time. But I am also willing to say, hey, I think this house is on fire. And, you could see that this summer, as you wrote about, in the conventions that were held once every 12 years, the Methodists, Presbyterians, and Episcopalians all meet in the same summer in their big national meetings. And that was this past summer. And it was interesting to watch the three meetings of the three denominations. You wrote about the Episcopal Church. But in some ways, their meeting was the most promising and optimistic of the three meetings. The Episcopal Church actually voted – once you move away from the sort of the hot-button issues of sexuality, especially the things about transgendered ordination and homosexual marriage, and you look at the sort of the broader scope of what the Episcopal Church tackled, it was very interesting. One of their set of resolutions was actually to take themselves completely apart as a denomination, and to try to figure out what it would mean to restructure the entire institution mm-hmm. of the Episcopal Church based on a vision of mission rather than simply a vision of how are we going to maintain this big organization. And so they very seriously understand the crisis that they're in and are taking measured steps. I don't think they should probably be moving a little faster, but it's a big organization. It's an old one. But they are taking measured steps to try to think about some of the issues I think that you actually raise about what does a healthy Christian institution look like for the 21st century. But the Methodists and Presbyterians did not do that. They're in a muddle.
You are on the same page as to where we are with some very little delineations in the severity of it. But so you diverge. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want each of you, if you will, to speak about the diversion for a second because I want us to be able to talk about those. So Mr. Douthat, why don't you go first? And it's a kind – I think both of you are talking about a kind of next step recovery. Where do we need to be going? And you say one thing, Mr. Douthat. You say another, Diana. And so would you, Mr. Douthat, kind of describe where you see it going and then we'll begin to pick into all this?
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, we both see a crisis and we both see opportunities, and I tend to lean more towards the crisis side and she mm-hmm. tends to lean more towards the opportunity side. And that reflects, I think, some pretty significant theological disagreements. I think that ultimately any kind of sustainable Christian revival has to be what I describe in my book as an orthodox revival. And I'm using the term sort of small o orthodox, meaning a kind of ecumenical orthodoxy that encompasses the Eastern Orthodox churches, my own Catholic church, and most of the historic Protestant denominations as well. But that's ultimately rooted in the idea that there is a kind of, you know, unchanging core of Christian faith, right, that dates back to, you know, to the first century AD, dates back to the great ecumenical councils of the church in the fourth century, you know, finds expression in the canon of scriptures, the Nicene Creed, and so on. And then also I think finds expression in certain basic moral commitments having to do with a skepticism of materialism and great wealth, a strong emphasis on chastity and sexual matters, and so on. And I think that, one, that constitutes the core of Christian faith, and two, that I don't think that there is a sort of correlation where you know, the most orthodox churches are necessarily the most thriving ones. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. A lot of what we describe as quote-unquote conservative religion in the United States is conservative in the sense of being politically conservative, on the conservative side of culture war issues to some extent, but I think departs from Christian orthodoxy in profound ways. And if you think about a figure like Joel Osteen and sort of the influence of the prosperity gospel on Christianity in the U.S., I think you can see an example of that. So I don't think – I'm not coming forward with a blueprint that says be more orthodox and, you know, and you will grow. Instead, I'm sort of arguing that you know, that orthodoxy is the truest form of Christian mm-hmm. faith, and that a Christianity that sort of seeks self-consciously to move beyond that core will, you know, one, eventually sort of cease to have any kind of Christian identity at all, and two, that as that's already happened in American life, it's produced overall fairly negative results. And so my sense is that you can already see what a Christianity after religion, a Christianity after church looks like in the U.S. today, and it's visible in sort of polls of sort of the younger generation and their views about God and morality and so on. And it's overall not a positive picture. It's a more narcissistic picture, a more sort of self-absorbed picture, and so on. So I'd say that's sort of a – that's my overview. And how about yours?
I think that some of the difference we have certainly is theological, and I'm very excited about that. I would have responded to your last response to me, except I got the flu, and so I was down for 10 days.
And here we are today.
And so I was sitting in my bed thinking, I want to write a thing, and it would have been engaging more theologically. But I also do think that it's a difference about where we're looking. And one of the things that I've done over the last decade, and you may or may not be aware of that, is that I've spent a lot of time with the microclimate, as it were,
right,
of Protestant congregations. And so I know all the research you're referring to about young adults, mostly conducted by Chris Smith out of North Carolina, and so I'm aware of this kind of thin gruel of picture of what Christianity looks like that does show up in the national polls. But what I'm also very aware of is that sort of off of everybody's radar screens, there has been developing over the course of the same period of collapse, what I would call sort of isolated congregations that are demonstrating a whole different kind of vision that arises out of the old liberal tradition, but is also something different. And those congregations are congregations that are not necessarily interested in saying, you know, we are orthodox. They don't start with that kind of language or that kind of doctrine test. But they do start with the story of Jesus and who Jesus was and what Jesus intended for human life. There's been a huge recovery in many congregations in the mainline tradition of understanding Jesus' great command to love God and love our neighbors as ourselves, and to try to stitch together a congregational or communal life that's really based out of this deepest sort of core teaching of Jesus himself. So it's not necessarily a return to the core teaching in the sense of the creeds, but a core teaching of looking at the life and ministry and work of Jesus and saying, well, what was that all about? And what is really the center point of being a follower of God as Jesus himself taught and lived when he was here on earth? And so there's been this passionate sort of recovery of biblical reading in many liberal congregations, of really sort of searching out the stories and ancient texts of Christian tradition and asking what those things have to do with living a contemporary life. There's a deep and renewed commitment in some of these churches towards practices that come out of Christian monastic tradition. You are as likely in some mainline congregations today to find people who are familiar with the rule of Saint Benedict, right, as you are to find people who are voting for President Obama in November. And that's something that the media doesn't actually know, that there is this very sort of committed, serious, not necessarily creedal in the sense that you're talking about creedal, but a group of people who are deeply aware of the ancient traditions of Christianity and are trying to take those traditions and make them make sense in a contemporary context. So that's the sort of microclimate that I've spent time with, and indeed the first several years of the decade, the last decade. I actually had a big grant from the Lilly Endowment where I went out and researched those kinds of churches and wrote a whole book about that. So it's not, from my perspective, kind of anecdotal congregations here and there, but you can actually track what I would call a renewing or sort of a micro trend in the larger picture of liberal Protestantism that is incredibly promising and actually follows through on a new passion for Christian story, Christian narrative, the biblical texts themselves, and a sincere life of practice. And it's changing things on the grassroots level.
Well, you're going to have to press us to disagree with each other because, of course, I'm going to spring in and say that I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that, you know, I'm a political conservative, obviously sort of in a professional capacity, and also obviously a theological conservative. But I think, as I said in the original column and would say today, that, you know, American Christianity needs a liberal Christianity in the sense of that it needs a Christianity that is identified with social reform, you know, and sort of in some sense, you know, the idea that Christianity should manifest itself in sort of political concerns and struggle against injustice and so on. And you cannot have a vibrant American Christianity that only appeals to people who are members of the Republican Party. And to the extent that what you're describing is a real phenomenon within liberal churches and congregations, I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think it is exactly what liberal Christianity needs. It needs not to give up on, you know, its commitment to social justice writ large, the language of the social gospel and so on. It just needs to reroute that language and those commitments in a, you know, in a biblical and more ancient, you know, more ancient Christian faith. So I think that there's interesting overlap listening to you talk between the way, you know, among more sort of self-consciously conservative believers who find themselves sort of weary of, you know, the culture war as embodied by Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and so on. There's also a focus on these sort of grassroots initiatives and, you know, small churches and what I describe at the end of my book as, quote unquote, the Benedict option, right? You mentioned mm-hmm. the rule of Saint Benedict. And there are a lot of sort of what you might call crunchy conservatives mm-hmm. in a way who see, you know, who see the way to build a future for conservative Christianity in the United States is to be mainly about building similarly communities of practice that model Christianity to the culture as a whole. So there, I think we're in agreement. So you should press us to disagree.
Let me tell you what I hear as criticisms of each of your positions, because I'd like to hear you respond to that. There are a lot of people who say, for example, that Mr. Douthat, when you talk about a core of Christianity, that has to be protected, it has to endure for the integrity of the religion, that you're wanting to simply retreat into the old hierarchical Christianity in which there was privilege and in which there was security and in which you basically didn't mix it up in the social process. You just stayed with, well, I'm going to be a doctrinaire Christian. On the other hand, Dr. Bass, with you, I hear people saying, well, you know, she and her kind have just given up on the gospel. They rightly want Christianity to be relevant, but in service to making Christianity relevant, they have weakened it to the point that it's a kind of Christianity light doing social policy that is stronger than Christianity itself. So I'd like for both of you to respond to those respective criticisms, because I think it'll help people understand better where each of you is.
Yeah, I appreciate the criticism, actually, because one of the things that I take from the liberal Christian traditions is that there are self-correcting mechanisms within it. One part I liked best about your book, Ross, was the really great discussions of neo-orthodoxy. And when I look at Christian history, I see neo-orthodoxy as one of those self-corrective moments right. of Protestant liberalism, where, you know, people like Barth and Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr. and other folks who are in the neo-orthodox tradition looked back and said, well, liberalism got this stuff right about social justice, but it also became too full of its own self. It was full of hubris, and that it was not full enough of God, nor was it full enough of
an awareness of human sin.
Yeah,
and the imperfect abilities
right.
of human nature.
Yeah, of human sin, and so you get this whole then generation of people who try to take sin as a seriously doctrinally, and also the idea of humility seriously doctrinally, and they remake liberalism on it. And you can actually, I think, argue successfully that the energy and the growth of a lot of mainline churches after World War II are directly the result of that theological self-correction of liberalism. So to take that kind of vision about what the liberal tradition can do is when it goes off the rails, it does have the capacity to correct itself. And I think that in the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a whole new generation of young liberal theologians and church leaders who have been involved in that project. It started around 1980 with the theological voices out of Yale of Hans Frey and George Limbeck articulating for the first time something that was called post-liberal theology. And that group of students who were in mainline seminaries in the 1980s took some of that insight from the post-liberal project, as it were, and began to apply it in congregations. And I think that's what you see today in those pockets of vitality where I was talking about mainline churches that are doing well. It's really sort of taking the emphasis from post-liberalism, which was to go back and re-examine tradition, and it was to go back and to recommit ourselves to the stories of ancient Christianity and also to base life around the idea of sustained practices in community. It took those three insights out of the post-liberal tradition and began applying them in congregations. And so now we've had about 15 or 20 years of this on the ground, very mealy sort of self-correction of liberal tradition going on. And so to me, yes, I think that the liberalism I grew up with in the 1960s in my Methodist church in Maryland, it stunk. It was boring. It was irrelevant. It offered no possibility of a young person like myself who was passionate to live a life in God to connect in any meaningful way with Scripture or with Jesus. But that kind of liberalism is now just kind of a stereotype of what liberalism used to be. And what it has become in some of its quarters is this very alternative, extremely demanding, different way of living one's life in congregations. It's not every congregation. It's a small percentage of congregations, the people at Hartford Seminary who do all this number crunching stuff. I've had them try to run their numbers on this, and they think that maybe 8 to 10% of mainline congregations demonstrate some level of this commitment to sort of postmodern or post-liberal sort of stuff. So it's by no means everybody, but it's a lot of people.
Look, both of you, go ahead. answer.
Well, I was just so two points, right? First, a quick one to your objection to my point of view,
right.
Or to your phrasing of the objection,
right,
to my point of view. I mean, in general, I would say, and you know, I think the example she was just citing helped to make this point. I think people often tend to underestimate the extent to which dogma sustains practice and even sustains activism, or especially, mm-hmm, sustains activism. Mm-hmm. And that if you look at in American history, certainly the great social reformers who were influenced by Christianity, they tended to be in certain ways extremely biblical in their faith, extremely dogmatic in their faith, often fairly supernatural in their faith. And this is a line that runs back from Martin Luther King through William Jennings Bryan back to the abolitionists. And so to the claim that a more dogmatic faith just serves to sort of reinforce existing social hierarchies, look, obviously sometimes that's true. And, mm-hmm, you know, I'm Catholic, and the Catholic Church has a long history of sort of complicity with existing power structures. But then again, if you look around the world today, you see parts of the world like Latin America where the Catholic Church was a force for reaction and sided with military dictatorships against communists and socialists and so on. But then you see other parts of the world like Korea, East Asia, and often Africa as well. And again, these are places where the church is less embedded in existing social hierarchies and it becomes an agent of reform, Catholic bishops and cardinals and so on. So I think it can run both ways, but I think dogma does not have to be an impediment to reform and can even assist it. And then second, to your point about sort of whether we're living through a kind of equivalent of the neo-Orthodox moment, you know, where liberal Christianity is finding a way to self-correct, what I see as missing, and this is maybe where we can get some real disagreement,
sure,
going, is I think that if there were a kind of, you know, a Reinhold Niebuhr of liberal Christianity today, right, somebody who, mm-hmm, was sort of within the liberal tradition but was really focused on where liberal Christianity was getting things wrong, he would be focused on sex. I think that liberal Christianity has a sex problem, and I think it's an understandable sex problem, because I think liberal Christians rightly during the era of, you know, the era of sort of the feminist revolution in the 60s and 70s, and then also to a certain extent with the gay rights revolution, you know, had a deep and appropriate desire to overcome sort of elements of bigotry within the Christian tradition, elements of sexism and so on. But I think that commitment has tended to carry liberal Christianity to a point where it ends up effacing or ignoring what I think is the pretty plain message. And again, we're getting back to that question of a core, but the, mm-hmm, pretty plain message of the New Testament, Jesus himself, the witness of the early church and so on, which is Philip Reif had this, you know, he describes it as a rejection of sexual individualism. And I think if you look at American society today, I think it's fair to at least submit the possibility that we're living through an era where sexual individualism has kind of run amok. Mm-hmm. And I think that the liberal churches, again, for reasons having to do with a desire to defend the movement towards female equality and to sort of avoid the tendency towards homophobia, have failed to maintain a language that speaks to those issues. And bracketing the question of homosexuality, have failed to develop a language that speaks to issues like premarital sex, divorce, mm-hmm, out of wedlock, childbearing, and so on. And if I were sitting here with a Republican Christian and so on, I think I'd be talking about money instead, mm-hmm, of sex, because you know that core has some pretty strong things to say about money. But I think in the case of the liberal tradition right now, and again, maybe it's different in these particular communities you're talking about, but I think there isn't a real confrontation with the gulf between what the New Testament says about sex and the way we live now.
I think that Americans have a sex problem. And
maybe humanity has a sex problem.
I think that that might be part of the sin. Genesis has something to say about that. You know, I appreciate what you're talking about, and I spent a good part of my life in conservative evangelical churches, mostly when I was a teenager and a young adult, and was educated at an evangelical seminary. And there were huge problems related to sex there, too, and they were actually problems of individualism. I can remember probably about 20 years ago, Leadership Magazine, which is one of the publications of Christianity Today, conservative right. publication in America, they published an expose by a major evangelical Protestant pastor who would not put his name on the article about sex addiction among mainline or not mainline, among evangelical pastors. And boy, that article, it came out right as I was at the end of seminary, so it might be even as much as 30 years ago now, which I hate to say. But that article was Xeroxed off and passed person to person to person among young evangelical leaders at the time, because everybody in the community knew it was true. And that kind of same kind of individualism that you can see express itself in some of the more radical parts of the mainline around homosexuality or some forms of sexual expression that are outside of the tradition is also happening within conservative Christian circles, but it's happening not publicly. It's happening privately. And it is happening to the point where it's destroying the marriages of conservative pastors, where it's undermining the mission and ministry of conservative churches and seminaries. And it's been very much a secret phenomenon. There have been in more recent years a few studies about that. And so I think that this tendency towards a whatever makes us feel good kind of sexuality is just a tendency of human nature. It's a tendency of sin, and it riddles its way through religious institutions depending upon the languages and theologies and practices and structures institutions.
And I'm Roman Catholic, right? So we should go there, because obviously, the American Catholic Church and to some extent the global Catholic Church as well has had a huge sex abuse problem that everybody listening or watching this show is very well aware of. And I think that the phenomenon you're describing is exactly right. There isn't some conservative Christian cure for, the way sex and sexual sin manifests itself. But what tends to happen in debates within the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. which is obviously the area I'm most familiar with, is something like the sex abuse crisis happens. And then the more sort of theologically liberal voices within the church will say, well, this proves that priestly celibacy is a mistake, right? This proves that the Catholic Church is too hung up on sex mm-hmm. and needs to sort of get over those hang-ups and, move into the 21st century and so on. And it's that point that I think is just – I think it's pretty much flat wrong, because I think it is – the reality of sexual sin makes it all the more important for Christian institutions to offer some kind of countersign, some kind of manifestation, whether it is the call for priestly celibacy, the emphasis on chastity before marriage and, continence within marriage and so on, a sort of if not a prohibition, at least a strong disapproval of divorce. That countersign is made more important by the reality of sin rather than being necessarily undercut by it. And that, I think, is what I tend to see as missing from liberal Christianity, is sort of a way of manifesting that countersign.
And the language and some of the theology that's been developing around that has been part of the discussion, say, in the Episcopal Church about homosexuality, but is not the piece of the discussion that makes the front page of the paper. And the way in which some liberal Protestants are discussing these kinds of issues now and trying to teach our children – I have a 14-year-old daughter. Believe me, these things matter to me deeply. And one
18-month-old daughter already dreading.
Give me a call
years.
In a few more years. One of the things that we talk about in our family, and certainly in traditions that I'm familiar with, are practices like, what does it mean to honor one's body? And that comes out of Scripture. It comes out of the ancient tradition. It comes out of the idea that the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, that God occupies, as it were, our bodies. And to teach that to our children is not just to teach them a Bible verse to memorize or some sort of ancient belief, but instead is to say, this is really what the community over time thinks about our bodies, and that this needs to be honored. It needs to be honored in us. And so sexuality becomes kind of a part of a whole, more holistic discussion, particularly with daughters, about things like eating disorders, whether, you know, how far you go with your boyfriend, whether you stay, you know, is celibate before marriage, how you relate to people who have, you know, different perspectives of this, who are in middle school with you.
Different perspectives in middle school.
Yeah, that's where it starts. And so honoring one's body is a place that liberals really can start with this. And also, you know, I know you know Andrew Sullivan. I don't know him personally, but I certainly have read him on this. And you know, his whole argument for same-sex marriage, marriage equality, is honoring the traditions of monogamy, right, and chastity and beauty that the Christian tradition teaches when two people commit themselves to a life of faithfulness. So I think there are ways to do it from a liberal perspective and that are really theologically rich and are in line with the tradition, not quite, not woodenly, but in an open sense, where it's not just about rampant sort of sexual freedom in mainline churches. You really can't go to most mainline churches and expect an orgy on the altar. You know, it's just not happening.
No.
People are a lot more conservative than that.
Look,
in some sense.
I'm going to interrupt because it's interesting to me that I hear in your language and in your presentation on this, I hear more of the differences between you than I've heard on anything else that you've answered. You're talking about honoring the body. You're saying no divorce, no sexual promiscuity, and that's more the core traditional language. This is more the relevance, try to relate language. Okay, what does each of you most disagree with in the argument of the other?
Well, the conversation that we're just having actually points to it. And Ross had said it actually earlier. And that is, he says he wants to begin with dogma and move toward moral formation. And actually, that's exactly the opposite way that I move. And I think that
– So say how you move.
Well, the example that I just gave of starting with a practice, honoring one's body, and then moving toward belief or doctrine or dogma is the way that liberals are currently, and post-liberals, if we're talking about that tradition, the renewing tradition, the way that we move. We start in practice. We start in sort of the lived experience of the community over time, because we include the longer historic experience of the church. But it's out of practice that we come to form belief and doctrine rather than the idea that there is an unchanging core of faith that you give your life to and then out of that develop a set of practices. So I actually hear that as exactly the opposite.
I think it's a little blurrier than exactly the opposite.
But
for the sake of the argument, I think it is sort of the nub of the disagreement is the I think that you would agree that, you know, dogma isn't inconsequential, and I would agree that, you know, sort of person that experience and life and community isn't inconsequential. But the relative weight that we give to dogma, I think, is the biggest difference between us. And the relative weight we give to the importance of sort of, you know, specificity in commandments, you might say, right? I think it's
the authority
or the authority, right? Oh, right. And where to what extent does authority reside in the Bible, the church, you know, and sort of the historical deposit of faith, and to what extent does it reside in the experience of the community right now? And this really is, I think, the biggest sort of liberal, conservative, progressive, orthodox, whatever division you want to make, that's the biggest divide. It's the, you know, and it is sort of a chicken and the egg, you know, dogma and practice kind of question.
But it has consequences for which comes first.
Right. And it has consequences for how, I mean, to get back to sort of where you were saying that liberal Protestant communities are trying to begin, gets back to, you know, how do you think about the words of Jesus? How do you think about the function of the New Testament message in the life of faith and so on? And how do you think about the authority of that message? And how far are you willing to go in revising that message depending on personal experience and contemporary realities? And my view is that the temptation in liberal circles is to go so far that you end up unraveling the – you know, you pull the thread out so far and suddenly you've unraveled the place you began. And then it's sort of, well, why are we Christians again anyway if we think that Jesus got this wrong and Paul got that wrong and it was the first century and they didn't know what we know now? You know, if you see what I mean. I think that's the danger, that you follow the thread so far that you look back to the beginning and say, well, you know, Jesus, nice guy, got a lot of things right, got a bunch of things wrong. You know, Buddha, same way. We're sort of mixing and matching, and then you aren't really, you know, there isn't any there anymore. That's sort of okay. – that's the apocalyptic.
That's the stereotypical.
You have a quick comment on that?
Well, about 40 years ago, an Episcopal theologian who unfortunately died far too young, named Urban Holmes, wrote an incredible essay called Praying Shapes Believing. And I think that that essay has had sort of a seminal impact on certainly me, but I think also a lot of what's going on in the mainline is that our beliefs really do spring out of the life of liturgy and prayer, out of how the community lives together in those places. And so it is a big disagreement about the order of these things, although there are, as you nicely say, there's a lot of nuance there that you can walk into.
Conservative Catholicism is not exactly an anti-liturgical community, right? I mean, you know.
Right, and liberal Episcopalianism with its recitation of the creed every week is not exactly an anti-Orthodox
community. No, you will hear the creed recited more often in certain liberal congregations than you will in notionally conservative megachurches and so on. That's absolutely the case.
So that whole sense of practice preceding belief, I think, is really important. And what you say about belief preceding practice, that those are the – you can run to the edges of those and find the stereotypes, or you can have a really good discussion that we're having that begins to sort of understand the nuances of that and how that works together for what could be the good of Christianity in America for the future. Because for the stereotype of liberal Christianity, you know, the stereotype of conservative Christianity isn't very good either. You know, if you put belief before all this other stuff, before community, you wind up with witch hunts and all kinds of oppression of people. And that is not pretty. As a matter of fact, there are probably more people right now who are leaving Christian churches because they think that Christians are narrow and bigoted and dangerous than there are people who are leaving because they think Christians are kind of goofy and, you know, maybe theologically sloppy.
That's because the people who left the churches for those reasons left over
gone.
The last 30 years.
Those people are already out. But, you know, there is more of a stereotype right now about this sort of, you know, a hyper-orthodoxy leading to a kind of a fundamentalism that is hurtful to democracy and hurtful to individuals who are seeking to have a, you know, meaningful life.
And I've got to jump in because I've got two questions I want to ask while we're still on the air. One, for each of you, what if you're wrong? What if your position's wrong?
Hey, you're talking to a girl who grew up in evangelicalism. If I'm wrong, I go to hell.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. You know, we Catholics believe in invincible ignorance. Everybody can get in. You know.
But it's a serious question. I mean, what are the consequences if you're wrong?
Well, what's the context of my wrongness? We're right that there is a God and so forth.
Because
if there's no God, that changes a lot of things.
No. Right. I am presuming that both of you are concerned about contemporary Christianity, its integrity, its vitality, its relevance, how it's going to survive. And each of you has a conviction about what needs to happen for organized Christianity to realize its potential, So what if your perspective is wrong?
Well, I guess I'll start. If my perspective is wrong, then I and people who agree with me will be, you know, remembered the way – I mean, you know, there's always a tension between doctrine and contemporary reality, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And there's always an entanglement. You know, we live in a fallen world. There's always an entanglement between the church and the culture, between the church and existing biases and power structures and so forth. And there are times when people, Christians, making the conservative argument end up becoming too attached to those power structures, those habits, those biases and bigotries, and not recognizing that the core of Christian faith is pointing in a different direction. And so in that sense, if I'm wrong, I'll be remembered as one of those Christians, right, as somebody who just didn't see that it actually, you know, didn't compromise Christianity to shift significantly on sexual ethics, and that actually that was as necessary a shift as the Catholic Church's shift on religious liberty, right? Between, mm-hmm. you know, so the Catholic Church had one view of religious liberty in the 19th century and a different one post-Vatican II. And there were continuities between the two views, but there had been a shift. And I think that was a positive shift. And I could list other positive
right.
shifts.
Right.
So in that sense, there's always the possibility that as a conservative, you're privileging your conservatism over your Christianity. And that's something that anybody on my side of these debates has to keep in mind.
What about you, Diane?
I think
hellbound.
That's right. Feel the flames. I think it's interesting because as a person who does understand myself as liberal or progressive, is that I kind of always assume I am wrong. and so I spend a lot of time ruminating on where I might be wrong and where I need to be more humble and think through what I'm saying and make sure that the advice and the passions that I'm communicating to people who trust me and look to me to leadership are not being sort of seriously, you know, led down a garden path. So I think that when you ask the question about what happens if I'm wrong, it's not so much a personal thing, even though I did make the joke about going to hell, is that I worry about folks who take me seriously as a leader. And I think, well, if I'm wrong and I say something that they embrace and begin to practice in their communities and it winds up hurting the fabric of community, that becomes a huge and terrible burden to bear. Mm-hmm. And so I am thinking more about the impact of what I say in that larger cultural arena than I would be about my own opinions.
Second question is, what in contemporary Christianity most excites you? What are you vibrant about because it's happening?
The crisis is actually the thing that excites me the most. When I was little and, you know, growing up in the Methodist Church in Baltimore, I mean, you could say that there was crisis in the air. Certainly there was big cultural crisis at that time in the 1960s. But my Methodist Church was so dull that it was almost unspeakable. And now you go to church and some of them are dull, you know. Good for dull, but an awful lot of them aren't, is that people are engaged in some really interesting discussions in the ground level. People are having really fascinating arguments. The institutions are really struggling right now to pay their bills and think about what the ministry is going to look like for the future and who should be ordained and, you know, can we marry these people and not these people and what happens if we pray for this and public prayers. And so the whole level of energy and fervor and even argument is to me the place of enthusiasm, because it opens up a possibility that people are ready to change and that people do actually still love these old institutions and see them as valuable and mm-hmm. want them to continue in some fashion for the future, but they don't really know how to do it. So it's a great time for imagination and creativity.
Mr. Douthat?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to come to somewhere where we agree again, I think the in decline, there is the possibility and the reality that Christianity becomes countercultural in a stronger way than it's been at certain points in the American past. And, you know, Christianity is supposed to be a countercultural religion. It's a religion that was founded on the, you know, the crucifixion of somebody we believe to be the Son of God alongside two common criminals. You can't really get much more sort of counter the, you know, institutions of the age than that. And I think you can take that line too far. I mean, I'll have people say to me, you know, well, because Christianity is more countercultural today, that shows we haven't really lost anything and so on. I don't think that's right. I think we have lost a lot of things over the last 50 years. But it's still the case that a crisis is an opportunity, and it's a particular opportunity for a faith like Christianity that isn't supposed to get too comfortable mm-hmm. in any particular culture, any mm-hmm. particular time and place. And it's true. It's true for the mainline in their struggles. It's true for you know, more theologically conservative Christians who feel sort of marginalized. You know, you're supposed to be the salt of the earth and all that, and there are real chances to do that in a society that is a little more hostile mm-hmm. to your faith than it used to be.
What about the discussion that we've just had? Any surprises, any new insights, any sense of where the next stage or step of your ongoing dialogue, debate will be?
I mean, I sometimes like to think, and I go back and forth on this, depending on which blog post I've read in a particular day, but we've lived through an era of incredible polarization and real culture war and so on that was driven, I think, by these deep tectonic shifts in the 1960s and 70s. And so in my own Catholic Church, the previous generation of Catholics is just completely polarized between liberal Catholics who are like, you know, it's the spirit of Vatican II and we need to keep pushing that ahead, and conservative Catholics who are all about John Paul II and sort of, you know, shifting the direction of the church. And in my generation, I do at least see a possibility, and I think you can see this in some of the common ground we found in this conversation, that at least some of that polarization can become less important, and that sort of certain forms of common ground can be rediscovered by people who aren't sort of personally invested in something that happened in 1968. So that's sort of my hope. On the downside, you know, with my own book, I would sort of go up and down on that depending on which review I was reading, right? And sometimes I'd read sort of more liberal Christians saying, oh, Douthat is really saying some interesting mm-hmm. things. And I'd be like, yes, there's common ground there. And then I'd read what I thought was a viciously unfair attack from someone on the liberal side. And I'd say, oh, to the barricade, Sarah Palin for president. So, you know, you go back and forth depending on the day.
And what about you, Diana?
Well, I actually – part of the reason I do what I do in working with these institutions and writing these books, and, you know, it's certainly not because you get rich doing it. You know, hey, yeah, I get paid by mainline churches. You know, it's a great income stream. Part of the reason I do what I do is because I really honestly and deeply understand that the religious life in the United States is the underpinning of our democratic life. And anybody that cares about our life as community and the common good over the last 20 or 30 years really truly has to be heartbroken by the way religion has been sort of forced into boxes to serve agendas that wind up breaking us apart and not allowing us to really try to create a different kind of America for the future, a good America that picks up all the things that we love the most about what it means to be American. And so I care about religion, and I do care about finding these kind of conversations and creating some theological understanding. And I think that the only way that common ground can begin to be achieved in religion so that it functions as a seedbed for larger common ground across the culture is that when we address these issues in public, as we're both responsible to do, that we don't start with stereotypes and straw men and women of each other's positions. It's interesting. I can tell him this on air. My publisher, when your book came out, they wanted me to write an editorial attacking your book so I could sell my book. And
My publisher wanted me all the nasty reviews I mentioned. Of course, mm-hmm. they want you to respond immediately,
right.
And so on.
And so,
tough times for the book business.
It is tough times for the book business.
All hands on deck. If you had done so, I would not have been offended.
Well,
or I would have tried not to.
Well, I do understand that, but I read your book, and I thought. And I actually tried to write something that would be edgy and negative and mean to get attention to my work. And I literally sat at my computer and I couldn't do it. And my publisher was standing there going, "Where's that editorial? Where's that editorial? We want to send it to the New York Times." And I finally said to them after the longest time, I said, "There is not going to be any editorial." And I said, "You know, he has a perspective on this. I disagree with it. I think he's missing some of the point and that he stereotypes some of the things that I am deeply passionate about. But I don't think that it helps for me to come out and attack this person who I've never met just in the sheer commercial enterprise of selling books."
And she just has guaranteed herself entrance into heaven. right there.
When you did write the thing about the Episcopal Church, it was a natural opening to engage in a real discussion. And so, Welton, that's the answer for me,
okay,
is that I want a real discussion with people who are truly open to not just stereotype, but to have conversations about the importance of religion in American society so that we can be a better America.
I really appreciate both of you coming to the studio. I appreciate the kind of conversation we've had. One of my hopes always for State of Belief Radio is that we can model in some way the kind of conversation that needs to go on in America, whether the issue is religion or politics or some other item. And I think you all have done that well. I want to say in closing, and I'll give you an opportunity to rebut if you don't like my closing. It occurs to me that for a person concerned about authentic Christianity, that whether you start with where Ross is or whether you start with where Diana is, if you're going to be thorough in your thought, you have to give attention to what each one of you has said. In order to keep the whole thing together, because there is a tension in religion always that requires both an interest in the core and an interest in the relevance, and those two have to be held in some kind of tension, whether they come first, whether the application comes first, the practice comes first, as Diana says, or whether the core comes first, as Ross says. Thank you all very much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.